Hi there, everyone. Welcome to our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us again. I'm very, very lucky to have Leanne with us today. She is the head of SecOps for a large UK retailer. You've probably seen her podcast, seen her on LinkedIn, and has a lot to talk about today around her experience from outside of cyber as an anthropologist.
Cyber anthropologist.
And how that kind of transitions into what you do now and what you love. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll dive straight in.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for making the way over. I know it's a long journey.
Big, long journey into Leeds, yeah.
Just down the road. Lovely. But yeah, thank you so much for coming along. A lot of the people I've done these with, I've got a bit of a history of in the past, and I've known them for many years, but one of the guys here introduced us a few months ago, actually. Time is January has flown. I don't know about you.
Yeah, close my eyes and open it. Oh, it's February. Yay.
January normally drags, but this one just flown by. Anyway, a few months ago we were speaking as a bit of an intro. And myself, I've been out of cybersecurity, especially pen testing, for a good few years. Mm-hmm. I helped set up some companies and did some stuff around sales consulting. So for me, the real kind of kicker of this is just to speak to people and kind of get to know a bit more about themselves, what they've seen over the last few years, what you kind of see going on in the future, and then talk around a few different points of interest for yourself and what advice you'd give to people in the future. So, yeah, I'd love to maybe get your thoughts on what has kind of happened over the last few years in cyber, because it's been a bit of a mad world. So how's that kind of impacted things? What have you seen? And then a follow on from that, like, what are your thoughts for the future of cyber?
Yeah, so there's been massive changes, I think, in the world of cyber since I started on my journey. So I started off as a software developer who specialized in secure coding. And then I got into the SOC as a SOC analyst, and then into security transformation to the role I'm doing now, which is head of security operations. And it's given me a really good insight to see, because I still keep my hands in all those areas, being the head of security operations. Yeah. How things have changed since when, you know, I was actually doing the do to actually leading a function now. And what I'm seeing is the work is definitely getting harder in some areas and easier in others. So it's getting harder in terms of volume and the kind of level of threats that are going out there at the moment, that it just seems so unrelenting. But our saving grace is the tooling has really been there to kind of help us.
Nice.
But there is still that element that I'm seeing kind of consistently, which is alert fatigue and things like that. And obviously that's a massive concern, because as soon as you take your eye off the ball, then you've got trouble. That's when it gets hit. There is still, I think, and it's getting better, a little bit of difficulty getting buy-in from kind of the C-suite above about why security is important. I read an interesting article a couple of days ago, and it was from a ransomware negotiation company. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, actually, customers paying ransom has gone down to 29%. So when they first started doing the study, in 2019, it was around 89% of companies were paying ransomware.
Most were just paying it.
Just paying it. And they said, like, that's dropped dramatically last quarter to, you know, 29%, which is fantastic. Now they're saying it's because people are getting a lot more savvy about their backups.
Okay.
Which is great. Great news. Which means that they're less likely to want to pay because, you know, we've got robust backups. It's fine. It's not a big deal. And also because the news stories have been going around saying that ransomware gangs are not paying when not returning the data, you know, not keeping up to their promises of not releasing the data.
And then also, I've seen them then selling it on and giving it to other people. So they're not directly actually doing it again, but someone else is doing it and they're profiteering off that as well.
Yeah, exactly. So
I can see why that mistrust is.
But what kind of saddened me about that story was it wasn't the cybersecurity team that have been communicating that message effectively, going, great, have good backups, because, you know, it's going to serve as well. It's the mainstream media. So it's not tech media, it's not cybersecurity news stories or anything like that. It's, you know, your likes of your BBCs, your Guardians, you know, really publicizing this message. And it's just, we're still not landing these security messages. And I feel like that's probably one of the biggest challenges we're facing at the moment, is no matter how consistent our message has been, and it's been really consistent for decades. You know, have good, strong passwords that are unique for every site. You know, have backups, which is slightly working, but not because of us. Don't click on that, and if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Those messages are consistent, but they're not landing still because we're seeing it with the cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it in the erosion of our budgets in cybersecurity teams still.
I remember back when I was doing this, we used to do work with PR companies and the like to make sure that, you know, the talk kind of scenario doesn't happen. That's the standard one that everyone uses. And even back then, there was a massive flurry of media just pushing like constant, like every week, cyber attack. I feel like it's kind of dropped a little bit over the years. How have you seen that impact, or is it the media still portraying the same message but just not as regular as they were doing before? It's still, again, that wrong message, more of that kind of that fear rather than...
I think they're still doing the message consistently. It's just who are they aiming it at the moment. So whereas before it was like, this company's lost a lot of money. Now, most people don't really care if a company's lost a lot of money, especially if that company has, you know, a lot of money to start with.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of a David and Goliath kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
But when it's personal data, when it's you have been directly impacted, you are now at risk, this, you know, this has happened, you know, this could directly impact you and your daily life for who knows how long, depending on what type of data it is, then I think that message is the one that's getting the strongest recall.
Yeah, fair enough. Are there any kind of changes? Any other changes you've seen that kind of impact yourself? One thing I was thinking when you were talking through was that previously, and I've kind of heard around like technology fatigue, as in a sense as well. Like there's so many options out there, so many different tools to use. Has that become a bit easier for yourself? Do you see that continuing, or maybe taking a step back with the way the economy is going?
I think it's got harder, actually. As someone who is now. Fortunately, unfortunately, does have some buying power decisions. I'm bombarded, honestly, multiple times a day on all sorts of different platforms. I don't know how they get my details or anything like that, by vendors, all promising me the world.
Yeah.
And I can't tell the difference. So luckily, things like, you know, Gartner and stuff like that can help with making decisions. Word of mouth also helps a lot. But I think the market is so saturated with tools and products all promising to solve all my problems, it can be very overwhelming to know, actually, am I making the right decision? Because as I alluded to earlier, my budget isn't great, because no security team's budget is great, and I need to spend that money wisely, and so I need to be sure I'm making the right decision here. There's nothing worse in my eyes than buying a tool thinking it's the bee's knees and not utilizing it.
It's
just that incredible waste. I could have spent that on a person.
I've worked with a client a while back, and they had 50 boxes of a very, very, very popular tool back then, and they were just not on. They were purchased, thought it was great, no one really implemented it, just sat there, didn't really do the jobs. So it's like, there's a lot more pressure, right? Your budget's constrained, because I'm assuming the economic climate is then impacting things, and reduce money on spend, more focus on revenue generation. So then,
And these cybersecurity tools are not cheap as well. They're some of the more expensive tools in the tech market, aren't they? So, and you know, kind of understandably. But on another point, one thing I am seeing that is definitely changing is, and it's happening across tech, the candidate market. So it's really difficult to hire at the moment. Yeah. And I feel really kind of sorry for graduates that are just coming through the scheme, who've kind of probably been told for the last 3 years while they're doing their undergraduates or whatever, you'll definitely find a job in cyber, but it's really difficult, especially junior and early careers, to find jobs in cyber.
Okay. So the entry levels are all ones that require experience, or...
Yeah.
Or at least kind of, someone mentioned to me once, like actually within that market, just showing that you've played around with some tools rather than kind of going in from a grad and expecting, you're now expected a bit to try and build your experience without having the experience, which is really, really tough.
Yeah. So one piece of advice I sort of give around that is, think about how many people will be applying for this job, for this junior position.
Yeah.
Hundreds, honestly. I've always had to close my junior roles early because I just can't keep up with the demand. And you need to stand out. Yeah. You need to demonstrate why you above another 100 people I could possibly pick. But the difficult for me actually is in the more senior market, because people can afford to be picky, because we really need those skills.
Yeah. And the people who have the experience of being picky from a commercial perspective as well to to choose what's best for them financially versus actually the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you've got to entice people with what are you actually building in your organization? How is security taken seriously in your organization? Because I know for myself, if I was going to join a company and they don't take security seriously, unless my job is to make people take security seriously, then I'm not going to really enjoy that, am I? I'm going to kind of, why would you want to work somewhere where you're constantly banging your head against the wall to try and get things done? So I think for leaders, it's really important to start building that security culture.
Yeah.
So that not only are you going to be more secure overall because people know who the security team is and they respond to the messages you send out, but also you need to make great environments for these fantastic candidates that you could be missing out on if you don't sort of say, hey, this is a great place to work because you're actually making a difference.
And I guess it's the balance between, as you're saying, that budget constraints and that building that culture around being able to do something. Because as mentioned, I was speaking to Hazel the other week and we were talking about like that. A lot of people from cyber, whatever side, they're all really, really passionate about trying to actually deliver something and do something that's going to have a purpose in a sense. It's gonna be doing good.
I find that it's all about moving the needle forward.
Yeah.
With the work we're trying to do. I don't ever promise to anyone that you're going to see the end result, as in project work in my world is few and far between. I'm lucky at the moment that I'm building a whole function from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there are tangible outputs, but on a day-to-day working of a SOC environment, for example, it's more about getting through the day and thinking, actually, have I made this a little bit more secure? Have I moved that needle along just a little tiny bit more?
And I guess the balance between like what you're looking to do and the passion that you have to really drive things forward and what the business wants and where the budget's in that eye, you've got to find that delicate balance where you're doing everything that you want within the kind of within the parameters effective, what the business sees as important and what their security culture is.
Yeah. And I think roles like the SOC and incident response are kind of a bit of a poison chalice role because on paper they sound incredibly sexy, but the reality, and I've done it, you know, I've been a tier one SOC analyst and then tier two SOC analyst. The reality is, you know, a lot of kind of report writing, pulling spreadsheets, looking at dashboards, trying to make assessments that way. And then occasionally you get a little incident. Now, I shouldn't be smiling in glee at that, but occasionally it's a bit fun to have an incident just so that you know that you can flex those muscles.
Yeah.
But the actual day job, you know, touch wood, if you're doing the right things in your organization, you know, you might not see an incident that often.
Yeah. It's a kind of, I guess the proactive nature of doing that to making sure that those incidents don't happen is actually the positive part, because you're stopping them coming in. But then at the same time, there must be an excitement when something does come in for you to be able to show, like, okay, I'm great at protecting, but when something does happen, we can really respond as a business and respond. Because we know in history, lots of companies have kind of failed at that point. Mm. So to be able to do it and to test it, and you must run scenarios and test things as well on a regular basis to keep yourself alert and keep yourself going.
Yeah, building up really robust tabletop exercises and scenarios and things like that is incredibly important just to kind of keep those muscles from atrophying, really. Particularly, as I say, if you're good enough to not have them very often, then you really do need to rely on a bit of muscle memory and good documentation as well. Good playbooks, good run books for when things happen that you can really just pick it up. Because, you know, you can have the coolest cucumber in your team during a normal day, then an incident hits and then they completely crumble.
Yeah.
So you need that kind of backup because you never know how people are going to respond in an incident.
How do you see a difference between people doing the exercises and the real thing?
I have done, but only slightly. I think if you a good tabletop, your heart rate still goes.
Yeah.
I think that's something we're really good at as humans. And I kind of put my anthropology hat back on. We're one of the only species that can imagine a future beyond us. And so that really plays into our ability when we're doing tabletop exercises to actually incite a little bit of fear of like, this could happen. And that does serve you. And you want to feel that adrenaline spike because that's a learning opportunity. Because whenever you have an emotional response to something, that embeds that experience.
Yeah.
Which is why when you sat down watching, you know, videos, training videos and stuff like that for hours on end, it's good for a while.
Yeah.
But if you don't have like a little flare of excitement or anything like that, that's it. Think about the time when you went to the cinema and you watched a movie and you were just so taken aback by it. You can remember that scene because it was an emotional trigger.
You can feel it. You can see it. Your senses kind of kick in. But sometimes, yeah, training can be a bit.
Which is why it's so important to do these tabletops, not just with a cyber team,
yeah,
but as many people in the business as you possibly can. Now, it's so hard to get them all together to do that.
It's a lot of money and time taken away from.
It is. But if you, and I mean this in the best possible way, put on a show, you have to put on a show. If you for yourselves, you could probably get away with being a bit more stripped down. Invite any execs or anyone from the business. You've got to make it so worth their time. You need to put on a show.
Yeah.
And I would recommend, you know, definitely looking into, you know, if I was writing a script about a heist, how would I go about doing that? What would be my twists and turns for that?
Yeah.
To make it really interesting. And I actually heard on another podcast today that some company in America during the writer's strike actually hired script writers in to do tabletop exercises with them.
That's cool.
Because they couldn't actually work on film and TV during the strike. So they managed to do this as a job. And they were literally just sat in these meetings. They knew nothing about cybersecurity.
But they would
put in checks and go, well, what if this happened?
Yeah.
And what if this happened? And I think that's a fantastic way of approaching things. Can you imagine like how excited people would be? And instead of people going, oh, I've got another cybersecurity tabletop I need to go to, people would be like, Oh, next week, guess what? I've got a cybersecurity tabletop I can go to.
Yeah, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah.
We did a thing a while back, and on that, I think it was really exciting, but then there's the parameters of making sure that everyone is aware. I think in that situation, there was basically kind of took over, but sent an email of, we have your email to everyone, and it went a bit, I think everyone got involved, and there was a lot of adrenaline, a lot of excitement, but then it got to the point of like, okay, well, people start having a call, like the authorities and that, and it's like, well, hang on a minute, this isn't real, just making sure it's staged in that way, but then I say as exciting and maybe not too aware that people are looking forward to it and actually not thinking, oh, it's just another one of these things we have to do for a policy. This is actually enjoyable and look forward to the next one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to seeing what they look like. So what are your thoughts on the future of cyber? Where do you think things are going in the coming years? I guess from being in this perspective and from with your anthropology hat on as well.
I'm gonna say this, and you know, it's very buzzy at the moment, but AI really is going to have an impact.
Yeah.
So when I put my anthropology hat on, which I usually do for security awareness, to be fair. When I put my anthropology hat on, I think about, okay, so how do I teach people about phishing? What to spot? What to look out for? AI has basically just taken all that kind of good stuff that I've been honing and just thrown it out the window and said, I can replicate a human way better than most people can probably do anyway. So we're going to have to really re-examine the communication that we have with people, because I can't tell you if that's fake or not. Some people say like, oh, you can tell. Eventually, we won't be able to tell. No. It's going to get better and better, and it's going to present unspeakable challenges for us. Now,
but it's us keeping up with it, because I use it from a generative AI perspective, and I feel like I can notice certain things because of the time and effort I'm putting into it, and I kind of see that. And you start, humans, we pattern recognize all the time similarities. Yeah. But as you say, as it grows and as it gets more advanced, it's going to be really, really tough to identify that. And even keeping up with the technology, will we be able to tell the difference? And how can we stand above that?
But what makes me laugh is, you know, you see all these industry surveys and surveying CEOs of companies going, oh, do you think AI is going to have an impact on your organization in a couple of years' time? It's like, oh, yeah, I think so. It's like, guys, which tends to be honest, guys, it's already there. What's interesting about the AI revolution is that it's bottom up.
Yeah.
People on their individual devices, not IT steer, are already using this stuff, either with your knowledge or not.
Yeah.
And the genie's out of the bottle. So I'm not one for banning things. I'm one for negotiating, understanding what's the business case. You know, I think this tool is going to be too important for us to ban, but we definitely need guardrails.
Yeah, yes, that makes sense. We had a talk about that a few weeks ago, and then AI seems to be that conversation that is just, as you say, it's bottom up. It's not something that's been put in front of us and we have to deal with from a top-down perspective. People are using it and trying to find ways to make their lives easier effectively.
It's all about productivity gains. Yes. Obviously it is being used maliciously, but in the workplace, it's about productivity gains, which can all be a positive thing, which is why I'm very hesitant to say ban it and then we'll figure it out, because we're missing out on so many great things. And particularly in the cybersecurity team as well, I want people to use it for productivity gains.
Yep.
Because what I was alluding to earlier about making sure when I'm hiring people that it's going to be a fun environment for them, I don't want them to do the boring stuff. Let AI do the boring stuff, and then they can focus on the stuff that humans are inherently good at.
Yeah. I think the more the analytical, the data type side of things, especially from a SOC analyst, it can be, speaking to people who've gone through those careers, and like, it can be quite boring in a sense, because it's very monotonous and it's repetitive, but actually removing that layer, using technology, and then actually focus on the things that are more enjoyable.
I could only do it for a few years because I pulled my hair out. I was so bored. It was a cool job. There was cool things going on, but the actual BAU stuff, I was happy to move on from there.
Yeah. Outside of the AI as a kind of future, is there anything else that you see kind of impacting cybersecurity or SecOps specifically?
I would like to see, and I hope it is going to get better, that the CISO role has more of a seat at the C-suite table.
Yep.
Now, the C is in the name, but
yeah.
I know in a lot of organizations, they're still kind of one rung below the exec level. And I think that is causing problems. And whenever, there's a kind of question around, slashing budgets and things like that, that's basically the business saying they're happy to accept that risk.
Yeah.
And
you need someone to fight and actually say, we need to find where the right risk level is, not just accept it.
But the problem is with security, and I'm sure your listeners will agree, is how do you prove that this is working?
Yeah.
How do you prove that last year's budget was keeping you safe? If nothing really major happens last year, how do you prove that that was because the money that was invested, or you were just lucky? And that's a really hard narrative to sell when you're dealing with business people who want to know, if I put this money in, that's my return on investment.
Yeah. What am I going to get out of it?
Yeah. And that's a really hard conversation to have. So I'm hoping that the CISO role has a bit more prominence.
I was thinking, will the tools that we're using and maybe that elevation of the role in the future make it easier for us to then kind of like look at what that impact would be to the business and what the return is? I know there's certain things, and when we went and started creating a tool a while back, we wanted to make sure that we were mapping the threats and the kind of the commercial, the financial impact. So, and what that would be to the business. So yeah, I've not checked that tech stack at the moment, but I'm guessing as the technology develops, it'll become easier to say, well, actually, if this happened, this, and you've invested this money, because normal IT budgets, there should be X amount within for security, right? But then how do you prove that that is the same for this year as what will be next year? Has the threats decreased? Have they increased? What's the, and I guess tracking that and understanding the business risk and appetite is that challenge there?
Absolutely. And I really do think money talks when it comes to that. That is a very good convincer. This is how much it's going to cost, but this is how much we'll save if something happens.
Yeah.
And about selling it as a value add as well. Security is a value add rather than just a compliance piece. Yeah. About, it's beyond security. It's about reputation. Yeah. It's about building trust with customers. It's about keeping the business ticking over so that we don't have any downtime. And then again, don't annoy any customers if we've got downtime and things like that. It's about selling security in a different way rather than just, me and you talking about security going, oh, we know why we're doing this because of this and that and that. But the business don't really care about that. What they care about is, where is the next profitable element of my business going to be? Yeah. And that's building. Now, security don't really build things in the same sense that applies to, the software development department, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They're not feature-led, not feature-driven. And so it's really hard to kind of get those security tickets on the backlog when you can't actually say, I'm going to improve your revenue with customers. But you can say it will improve your revenue with customers because, good, strong code is less buggy in itself. Mm-hmm. So good, secure code is less buggy in itself. But also, you know, that reputational piece will come along with it. And if you can honestly hand on heart say as an organization that we really do take your security very seriously, which I know is a mantra that they all throw around as soon as they're breached. But if you can actually look yourself in the mirror and think, actually, we are doing our very best here with what we've got.
Yeah.
Then I think that's different.
I just wonder, how can you differentiate against the noise, like from the AI thing? There's so much going on. There's so much noise there. But then also everyone's saying the same sort of thing. How do you really differentiate your business versus everyone else's? And as you say, it's really tough to track that financially, to say, well, this is your return on investment. How do you make that noise that really shows that you are delivering value?
I would love for security teams to get in with the marketing teams and say, hey, actually, we designed this really cool logging in feature and it makes things a lot easier for our customers and they're safer. Why don't you put that in your next press release?
Okay, yeah.
So go about actually selling the features of security. It doesn't have to be like a major press piece. It's not like I'm going to sort YouTube ads and all of a sudden, you know, a company's just going to be like, oh, look at this cool login. No, but, you know, like tiny little murmuring. So if anyone kind of looks up that company and goes, ah, actually, they're talking a lot about security,
yeah,
they must care about security, which is not really what a lot of organizations are doing. A lot of organizations lead with, my product does this, but not my product does this. And these are the security features behind it, you know, to make sure that we're keeping you safe.
That's interesting. I've seen people talk about the technology, like, you know, tech stack, and some companies actually publish a tech stack. So this is what we've got, and the like, and they do videos and the like of you know, the tech part of it. But then security just gets missed. But if you're talking about the technology versus the marketing blurb of surely putting in, and it is 10 times more secure than it was before, something like that, just to add it in as a start versus just going full on security on it, that would be a good step, at least as a minimum.
I mean, for me, like, if I got my civilian hat on, I don't want to be dealing with hundreds of passwords, hundreds of times logging in, MFA and stuff like that. Figure out a way for me to make this easier so that I can log into your product as well. If you can really sell that, then you're going to see returns and gains anyways, just people going, your product's really easy to use and it's safe.
Yeah, it's simpler, and I know that I'm not going to be at risk for any of my financial data. That's interesting. Thank you so much for your insights. Our next part the segment we tend to go on to is more focused around, you know, what are you really passionate about? And I know you're doing a lot of different stuff, so I won't jump into it too much. But yeah, I'd love to hear what your topic of choice is and just kind of dive into what really excites you about that.
Well, it's a slight plug. I hope you don't mind.
No,
but back in September, I launched a podcast with my co-host. It's called Compromising Positions. And the tagline is protecting your assets, never leaving you exposed. And the idea behind that was, so I actually started off my technology career as a digital anthropologist. And I've been using that throughout my career, all the different hats I've been wearing, to the point where I am now known as a cyber anthropologist. So applying the principles of anthropology, which is the study of culture, how they are formed, how they develop, and how they eventually collapse, and applying that to cybersecurity practices. And that's all the way from end users, to customers, companies, and then the security team themselves, and including hackers as well. There's quite a lot of research around that as well, about how their cultures are formed. And the podcast came about because I was really interested in listening to other anthropologists, behavioral scientists, psychologists. And I thought, I want to get some of these people on and talk to them about cybersecurity and get their perspective on. So the kind of unique selling point for this podcast is that it's a cybersecurity podcast, but we never interview anyone who works in cybersecurity.
So the opposite. No, it's really good though, because you're bringing people in from specialisms and and I did an MBA a little while back, and one of the big selling points was that you're in a room with people from different industries and you're talking about a specific subject and you're all coming from different angles, and that's where the learning really comes from, of how to kind of innovate and how to develop things.
Absolutely. So this week we had on a designer and someone who specializes in change and transformation. Mm-hmm. And what she was sort of telling us about, and the reason why we wanted her on the show, was everyone is going through transformation and change constantly.
Yeah.
And as soon as anyone, you know, if I move my cup from there to there, that's a change, and it'll either upset me or not, depending on the type of person I am. And because of that, even just small change, how does that impact someone's working life? And how will that, so putting the cybersecurity angle on, how will that impact how I view cybersecurity controls? Am I going to be really annoyed because someone's moved my cup? And then I'm going to start doing kind of, you know, rebellious behavior, not necessarily malicious behavior, but rebellious behavior. I start thinking, I'm just going to use the same passwords and stuff like that. These tiny butterfly effects, this guest was telling us, will have an impact on the security of your culture. So you need to be mindful. If your organization is going through a major change, and then all of a sudden you think, oh, company's going through a major change, now would be a really nice opportunity to completely change the password policy. Don't do that.
Yeah. It's just another layer of change that's going to stress people out.
Exactly. And they will rebel and ruin those security controls for you. And so it's been a really interesting journey to get these people on. So we also interview people from tech backgrounds, but obviously not cyber. So, you know, you've got your devs and people working in data and things like that. And one of the kind of regular kind of questions we ask is, you know, what's your experience with the cybersecurity team? And how would you like the cybersecurity team to treat you?
Yeah. Instead of the top down, actually, you know, what would be more appealing for you and get it to work for those? Do you find different things for different teams, or what are you seeing as a collective? Lots of people just have the same way they want to be treated.
What's been really nice is that we, as a function, the cybersecurity function, is not the most vilified function. I went into this assuming, you know, that we were probably just going, oh, security will say no, security are a blocker. No, there's other worse departments, thankfully. So that was a good positive to take away.
Cyber's become cool over the years, right? So actually, I don't know, yeah. I think it's less of that, oh, it's, you know, having to do this, having to do that. Maybe the kind of mainstream press has kind of put an air of cool around it as well, that just has made it less.
Yeah, potentially. But what I really kind of enjoyed seeing is, yes, different teams need different kind of feeding and watering, as it were. Mm. Problem is, our messages are kind of one size fits all, which is probably why it's not landing.
Yeah.
Because if I've got a message for, say, the dev team, but then I'm using that same message for the dev team, who are highly technical and probably can manage quite a lot of stuff themselves, and I'm saying, hey, contact center, call center, here's the same cybersecurity message. Mm. And they've got deadlines, they're constantly on the phone. They you know, they've got all these tabs open.
Yeah.
Shared kind of resources. So maybe they've got shared passwords and things like that. That message is not going to apply. It's not going to be relevant. It's not going to be useful.
And also maybe the way you deliver it as well, because like I would say your dev team versus a contact center versus marketing, we're all different people and we have different ways of working and we have our kind of nuances and stuff. So actually, not just the message, but I guess the way or the format of the platform you deliver the awareness as well.
I mean, you try saying to a contact center manager, I need to take your call team off to do an hour's worth of cybersecurity training.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. Right. It's just not going to happen. So how do you deliver that message? You know, thinking about delivering micro messages, but you've really got to boil it down into what actually is important. And you only know what is important when you actually speak to these teams. And that's where the anthropology comes in. So one of the main principles of anthropology, the main research methods, is something called participant observation.
Okay.
Now, the participant word is key. It means actually getting involved. So it's not just observing, not just passively observing, but you're actually getting involved in those teams. And we don't do that enough in security. You know, when was the last time we ever went up to any team and said, we're about to put this security control in place, will this have an effect on you? Particularly a high, you know, charged environment like the call center, we're going to put this control in. Will it have an effect on you? How do you normally work? We never ask those questions. And then we wonder why it fails.
I can imagine the learning you're getting out of that as well, because you think you go in there with your perception of, well, if I did this change, I think this would happen. But actually they come back and say, well, slightly differently, I think this would really happen. And this is how it impacts me. And if you could do this, this might be a bit better.
One of the things I loved doing when I was a software developer was we'd build something and then we'd get the user research team would bring in people to test the things we've built. You know, we'd have a two-way mirror, really cool. And we'd built this lovely thing. We were like, all right, so what you do is you click here and click here and click here, and that's how you get to where you want to be. They never did that. Customers never did that. They always went to a different path that you thought they were going to do. And they could never find what you kind of said, this big right button here that's flashing here, click on this one, that's where you're supposed to go. They would go, oh, I can't find what I'm supposed to do. And stuff like that. Never assume people are going to do what you want them to do. That is, to me, that's the biggest message in security. It's the biggest message in organizations. Never assume people are going to do what you think they're going to do. You need to ask them. But not just ask them, you need to actually watch, because people always tell you what they think you want to hear as well. So that's why participant observation is really crucial. You need to really get embedded, not for a long term, because obviously not many organizations have cyber anthropologists, if any, in their teams or anything like that. But just long enough, like spend an afternoon just sitting, listening to call center calls, just watching what they're doing, asking questions.
Yeah.
You know, build up that trust and you'll find out so much about your organization, about the actual security of your organization.
It's interesting. I always go from a sales perspective and look at all, like, always talk to people, like, look at your customer journey. Like, actually, if you want to know how to make your business better, go and talk to your customers and understand that. And I guess it's looking at your customers, whether they're internal or external, and seeing where they go along, how they do things and what would work. And then to say observation is key, because if you try and do sample sets and focus groups, it all becomes a little bit unreal.
Plus, you know, nobody wants, even I don't want to go sit in a cybersecurity focus group, I'll be honest with you. No one else will either. If you've got a user research team in your organization, start making friends with them, because they know how to ask the right questions. So again, you might not have an anthropologist working for you, but you probably have a user research team or something similar. If you're building stuff, leverage them.
Use that across different parts of the business.
Just say, how would you tell them what you're trying to find out? What questions should I ask? And you'll just get so much more buy-in as well. Because the nice thing about humans is that we love it when people pay attention to us.
Yeah.
So people are, you know, if they've got time, people are quite receptive to give you that information.
People love to talk. Love to talk about themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right? So and moan. Moan and complain. So give them that forum to do so. But if you're a security team that's quite lofty, maybe a bit scary, because, you know, cybersecurity is an authoritarian role. It's a policing role. It's a finger-wagging role. That can be a hard stereotype to break out of. So one of the key things I say when I talk about cyber anthropology is you need to make sure that you're starting building up your reputation as an approachable team, someone people can come to.
Yeah.
You know, if something does go wrong, if they click on something, they're not going to be scared about, you know, punitive impacts. You know, they're not going to get fired for this. They're not going to be told off for this.
Yeah.
You just need to know about it so you can deal with it.
Become more open and upfront to sharing, I guess.
Yeah.
I remember, I don't know if you know, Vicky Gavin used to work at The Economist. I think what they did there, obviously the paper, the magazine, I think people get involved in like writing articles and just trying to find a way to get people involved in cybersecurity from the kind of ground up, as you say, like giving it to them and then seeing what they do with it and then bringing it back and then kind of sharing that with the business.
One thing I did at one organization, I'm hoping to bring it back into this one that I'm currently working at, is people loved seeing the stats. They loved seeing how many pieces of phishing emails, you know, genuine phishing emails we got in the organization, how many we blocked as a team. They liked seeing that. They liked seeing how many got through. They liked seeing how many of these emails had malware attached to it. They loved seeing those stats. And it was the feedback we used to get. We used to probably publish it once a month, so it'd be monthly feedback. And they're just like, I had no idea you were that busy. I just thought, you know, it'd be like one attack a week or something. Like, no, it's a lot.
Because you're doing all that proactive protection, right?
People
just don't really know what you're doing. And as we go back to the point earlier on, is showing that return on investment and actually bringing numbers back and say, these are the things we have done for the business. So, you know, we're not just there to tell you off every time you click on a wrong thing. But
it's telling a story. It's like, you know, what I would always end the comms with is like, every time you report this, you are helping these stats. You are helping make our job easier.
Helping other people as well, because they may come across it and they may be new, they may not know. If you're not sharing what you've seen that's come about, someone else may.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were lucky. We were lucky enough that one day the CTO had a really dodgy email. And I still to this day can't work out what the scam was, but it was definitely a scam email. And he was kind enough to let us share that email.
Oh, nice.
To the whole organization. And we did break down, you know, like I was saying before about what spot for phishing and stuff like that. And people were just so interested and they loved the fact that the CTO had shared this email.
And that went, I'm guessing, to the board level?
It went to board. It went to everyone. Everyone wow. got it, yeah. And it was just...
just people being willing to open, because like, if you click on something, you're like, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah, yeah.
And that fear really kicks in. Yeah. There's actually, what have I done? What can I learn from it? How can I then share it with other people so that, you know, they don't make the same mistake.
But also, you know, the reason why Netflix does so well is that we love a story.
Yeah.
And we in cybersecurity have fantastic stories to tell. You know, we have heroes and villains. You know, we have heists. And we just don't tell those side of the stories. We just sort of say, oh, another day, another click. And that's not an exciting story.
Yeah. I think the industry over the years, as it's kind of developed, I think maybe when I joined, there was just IT directors. There was no real cyber. A lot of people were just really hesitant to really tell anyone anything. So I think there's like leaders, we're sharing a lot more.
We are sharing a lot more. We could do better though.
Just within that environment, or do you think outside of that for the rest of the business as well?
I wonder, mostly amongst ourselves, because, you know, when a breach happens, people just kind of get a bit closed up and buttoned up.
Yeah, defensive.
And I kind of get it, but we're not learning from each other. We keep doing that.
No.
And what
it's
that
making it easier for the
and what that causes as well, there's a lot of victim blaming in cybersecurity, and we are the biggest proponents of it as well. So if one of our peers has an awful breach, and we'll just point and go, oh, you can't have been doing security right. One of the reasons we don't know if they're doing security right is because they don't tell us, you know, wasn't our fault this happened. Make sure your systems are protected against this and this, because we weren't. You know, that kind of sharing really helps. But then the other side of it is that we're just really scared as well. So it's easier to kind of deflect and do that kind of victim shaming, which you don't see in other crimes. Mm-hmm. So if my house got burgled, and even if I left the window open or something like that, you'd feel sorry for me. You'd just be like, those bloody criminals have done it again. You know, that burglar did it. It was the burglar's fault. He's the one that stole it. When it comes to cybercrime, the victim is the person who's to blame. You know, what have you not done to prevent this from happening? And that causes a really interesting way that we communicate about cyber. Gives people the willies so they don't want to report anything because we victim blame them.
Is that because it's not a tangible physical thing?
I think there's something to do with the intangibility of it. So, you know, if you think that, you know, if I go outside, maybe I'll bump into a policeman. You know, there's patrols, there's people doing things like that. Yeah, I can pick up the phone. On the World Wide Web, you're on your own. And so the onus of security comes down to yourself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a digital assailant in binary is really hard to kind of picture.
Yeah.
But the same principles of securing your house is the same for securing your system. So, you know, you lock your doors, you close your windows.
And it's always used. We have a conversation with people, do you have that basic, do you lock the doors, have you done this?
Yeah.
So we link it to physical, but actually when something does happen, we have that kind of negative kind of impact versus that. Oh, a victim kind of concept, which is actually what it really is.
And that's why they say the stats, the actual cybersecurity attack stats are actually really a lot lower than they probably are, because people just don't report these things. There's so much shame involved in being part of a cyber incident that people just don't report it, big and small, so individuals all the way down to big companies.
And so the people on the podcast you've had from different areas, have they been part of incidents or clicked on things and that have they then shared, or has it been more about the not knowing what to do, or is it still that shame?
So when I've had people in, so behavioral economics, behavioral scientists, and it's about I've been sort of prodding them to sort of say, you know, you've worked in organizations yourself, so you've done, for example, security awareness training. Mm-hmm. How would you apply things like nudge theory into security awareness training? Being choice architects instead and helping people make good decisions rather than the bad decisions, but still making people feel like they have the autonomy to make those decisions. Okay. Now, you know yourself, you know, remember when you were a teenager and your parents told you to do something, you wouldn't do it. It's exactly the same in the workplace. nobody likes to be told what to do. But if you can make them feel like that's their decision, they tend to want to do it.
So planting that seed to it's a personal thought rather than the kind of authoritarian and like parents telling you off sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's flashing back to kid. That's when you're told not to do something, you do something. But yeah. Potentially that's the way, you know, don't do this and they'll do what they should do. But.
Well, before I got into the cybersecurity team, and I would say to them, I would say, well, why are we doing it this way? And they would say, because I said so. Now, because I said so doesn't work for your kids. It's not going to work for your colleagues. No. You want explanations, you know, and, you know, the curious mind wants to know why. And actually, as I've kind of drawn upon quite a few times now, it's like that story is crucial. Like, tell that story, because people are just like, oh, I get it. Yeah. And we just don't do that very well.
How have you got any stories that you have told that have worked and have gone into the peaks and the troughs? And have you got any examples for the listeners that just,
yeah.
Maybe not a real life one, but a kind of maybe a template or a thought to maybe inspire a few people?
Yeah. So I've had a lot of successes of going in and, you know, if you work in a big organization and they do like mass induction days where, so you have like one day where there's about 200 people or something, you know, they maybe put everyone that's being hired in that month into an induction day. It's like this is a big corporate thing. Like this is us as an organization. This is your HR stuff. This is da 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 da. Get on those as a cybersecurity person. Mm-hmm. Now, don't go on there and start saying our cybersecurity policy is this. Our acceptable use policy is this. Please don't do that. That'll bore them to death. But go in and tell them stories about, you know, maybe times you've been hacked. We've all been victim to something, big or small. Unfortunately, I've got three stories to tell. So I tell them a story about when I got my first job out of uni, and I was working for an organization, a charity, and our IT was outsourced. Mm-hmm. And so we were constantly getting pinged with the Windows reminder, please update your systems, and, you know, remind me later. It was a running joke in the office that we would all just click remind me later. Now, what we didn't know is that patch was to stop a very specific vulnerability that was being exploited in the wild. And then one day we came into the office and none of us could access our computers.
Oh, no.
It all been completely taken down. Now, we were a charity and we were dealing with destitution. Yeah. So people were coming into our service that had not eaten in days, made homeless, drug addictions, awful situations.
So really impacting.
We were offline for a week.
Oh, wow.
So we could not help anyone for a week.
Wow. The snowball effect of that, and then say the butterfly effect of what that would have done.
We were making jokes about, like, remind me later. And
yeah. And then the seriousness of what really happened, and looking back, thinking, oh my God, I wish I would have just done it.
Yeah. So we were absolutely snookered there. And then more recent example, which is a good news story. It was Christmas a couple of years ago. I was on the bus and I get a ping from my 2FA from Amazon saying, hey, we'd like, you know, authorize this purchase in Scotland, and I'm in Leeds. And I was like, ah, okay. So obviously reject that ping. And that kind of stopped that attack. And just like little things like that, just telling little stories. And I think particularly from a cybersecurity professional saying, even stuff like this happens to me.
Yeah,
like,
I think that's a good thing to be open.
Kind
be
of none of us are safe here. So.
Yeah. I was working in a company and I was studying and something come through and I clicked on and I was like, oh, what have I done? And, you know, safely that it was contained and stuff. But
yeah,
you know, from that, it's just, people don't like talking about it. Even just saying it now, I'm like, should I say it? Should I not say it? But it does. It's that worry that you kind of thought, well, something did happen, but I learned from it, and people have learned from it, businesses have learned from it. So actually, there's a positive at the end of it. But trying to tell that story, and I love what you did there. You've gone and said like a scenario in a workplace, and also like a personal one, because you've got to make it real for people, because like your workplace, it's not my workplace. So actually, do we align? But when you put it to like the typical apps that everyone uses on their phone anyway, then that's just like, oh, actually,
that's another thing as well. Yeah, never try and sell a security message as protecting the business. Just say these same principles apply that we're telling you for your personal security apply for work as well. So that's always a little line I put at the end, like, let me just teach you how to protect yourself at home, yada 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 yada, and then this also applies at work.
big
yeah, do the same at work, like That's all I really want you to do. So yeah, no one really cares about your company's security. And if you think they do, then you're sadly mistaken. But they do care about their own. And as little, if they're doing good hygiene practices in their own personal security, then you're on for a winner, to be honest. So if you can sell the story that way.
Yeah, they naturally bring that into work, and actually trying to make it more personal will allow them to, lovely. Well, we'll make sure we share the link of the podcast as well.
Thank you very much.
Give more people to have a look.
But yeah, we were big in Denmark for like a week, and I don't know why. So
you went viral or something.
Yeah. So if any of your listeners are Danish speaking, can you go find some forum or something where we appeared? Very, very pleased. So Tark Denmark, but I don't know why we were so big for a week.
Let's have a look into that. But yeah, thank you so much for coming and sharing that story and your personal passion. I love it. We've spoken before about it, and it's just, I love when people are passionate about things that they're sharing. Like, you don't have to be doing these podcasts. Mm. Like, you're doing it out of the kindness of your heart. You enjoy doing something, you're sharing with others. And I think it's the more we share, the easier life will be, effectively.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. I've had some absolutely incredible guests, really wonderful guests. It's them that make the show. So I really would recommend your listeners, if you want to think about security from a different angle, these guests will definitely change your mind about a couple of things.
Amazing.